So the reading from today is Ruth chapter 1. That's on page 267 of the church Bibles, or if you have a large print church Bible, it's on page 436. Ruth chapter 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi, and the name of his sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephratites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab to live there. Now Elimelech and Naomi's husband died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other named Ruth. After they had lived there for 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness, as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud, and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people. But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? I'm not going to have more sons who could become your husbands. Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." At this they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. The woman exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning.
Shall we pray? Lord, thank you for your word. Thank you that you are a God who communicates. Thank you that you have given us this document that we can look in, and through it you speak. I pray for Josh as he comes to open it for us, and I pray that you will speak through him.
the message that you want us to hear this morning. Amen.
Thanks very much, Andrew and Sarah. We've been set up with Ruth here, and so what we're doing is we're doing a little series in Ruth in January, and then we're going to go back to Matthew and carry on our series in Matthew after that. Ruth is a lovely book. Lots of Old Testament books, they deal with the epic sweep of history, the rise and fall of dynasties and empires, and Ruth is all about a family. It's full of personal interest, full of characters that are attractive for their kindness and boldness. It's a story with no villains, really. And along with Esther, it's unusual in telling the perspective not of the sort of the great and mighty and the warlords and the men, but the women and how they get along with life in a world that is complicated. It's a lovely story. But I thought before I dived into it, I'd just set some of the backgrounds. How does this fit into the much bigger Bible story? It's not just in here as a sort of little story by itself. It fits into a much bigger story. And the first and last sentences of Ruth help us to know how this fits into the much bigger story. The first sentence locates us in the time of the judges. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So we're in the days of the judges. So after Joshua has conquered the land, the Israelites are finally in the land God promised them. There are a nation in this land. The people of God live in this land, but they keep forgetting God. That's the time of the judges. They keep forgetting God, and then they get judged. Enemies come and conquer them. And then they remember God again, and they think, God, help us. Pray for God to come and help them. He sends a judge, a rescuer, to rescue them. They're rescued from their enemies, and then they forget God again. So that's the pattern. There are heroes of faith like Gideon, but even they're pretty flawed, and the people as a whole are spiraling out of control, spiraling into darkness. And Judges ends with these words, in those days Israel had no king, everyone did as he saw fit. So there's a sense of chaos in God's people, there's a lack of unity in worship and life, often unbridled selfishness and idolatry. And so Ruth is started located in that era where God's keeping his promises, but God's people are really failing to live as his people. A time of chaos and difficulty when the judges ruled. So that's the setting. And then at the very end of Ruth, we get the link to the kings, to the monarchy. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of David. So it's all about how God's working out this rescue plan for this particular little family. But it's also about God's plan, big plan, to bring a king after his own heart, King David. It's about how an outsider, Moabite woman, Ruth, comes to live in Israel and ends up becoming great-grandmother to the king, who's a picture of an even greater king to come, Jesus. When Matthew starts his gospel with a genealogy of Jesus, Ruth is in the list. And so this book is a bridge between the time of the judges and the time of the kings, but that's also then a link in a chain that leads on to a greater king, to Jesus. So that's the big picture. But what we're focusing on today is more of the family, the intimate family relationship. The how does this portrait of family life teach us? Because Ruth has lots of very practical issues in it, doesn't it? Bereavement, immigration, courtship. And in one sense, what we're seeing today is just the setting the scene. So chapter one of Ruth sets the scene, sets the problem, which will be solved in the rest of the story. It's act one, it's the tragedy act. And resolution awaits actually the final act of the book. So what we want to do is immerse ourselves in the story, taste the disappointment and the bitterness and the grief that's displayed, and then say, what are the lessons we can learn from Naomi and Ruth? These women who are godly women, women who know and trust God and therefore are trying to wrestle with these difficulties of life, to live out faithful to God in the midst of those difficulties. And the first lesson I think we learn from chapter one of Ruth is this. Remember, you're not the first to taste the bitter disappointments of life. So we want to use our imagination to think, really, what was it like for Ruth and for Naomi and Ruth? And we're doing that not because we just sort of like seeing other people suffer, but because we are also people who've tasted bitter disappointments. And if we haven't yet, we certainly will do at some point. And it's really helpful when we face those disappointments to remember we're not the first to face those sort of disappointments in life. The Bible is full of characters who drank deeply of the bitter cup of disappointment. And God puts them there so you can see he doesn't just deal with the lucky few who escape troubles in this life. He deals with people who have disappointments. We start out with the story of Naomi and Elimelech, verse 2. They get married, and we assume they have all the hopes and dreams of a young married couple. And there in Bethlehem, their name means house of bread, they enjoy their golden years. Good harvest. First one baby boy, then a second baby boy. And Naomi's name begins to seem like a prophecy. It means pleasant, and her life was pleasant. In a society in which sons were needed to inherit land and work the family farm and provide for your old age, she's produced two sons, and they're growing up. Boys grow up. Naomi rejoices in her heart. Perhaps she would have said, like Mrs. Bennet in Pride and Prejudice, when she's married off her daughters, God has been very good to us. And she'd have meant it. God's kindness was tangible. But then we get the first hint of trouble, verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. There's a shortage of food, possibly linked to God's judgment on his people. That the house of bread is empty of bread. And so Elimelech leads his family to Moab to get food and make their living there. And after some time in Moab, the first disaster struck. Elimelech died in Moab. We're not actually told in the narrative, but there's a little bit of a hint. Maybe this is sort of a sign that he made the wrong choice when he led his family out of Israel and into Moab. But whatever the case, whether this is judgment or not, Naomi is left a widow, mourning the death of a husband, a good husband, probably. She's never going to be the same again. There will always be loss in her life now. But she still has her boys. And they're old enough to work the land, so the family is kept going financially. They're good boys, they're growing up to be good men, and they get married to local girls. And there's a little bit of disappointment there for Naomi, because obviously they should have married Israelite girls, like that's the proper thing to do. Because these Moabites, they worship false gods, not the real God. But they're good women, Ruth and Orpah. Kind to their husbands, kind to Naomi. They join in the family worship of Yahweh. And so there was all this excitement and hope of organizing weddings and watching the next generation form their family units. And, well, she might be widowed, but Naomi is not alone. And at first it's all great. And then the nagging issue emerges. Where are the grandchildren? In our own culture, childlessness is a hugely painful issue. But it was even worse back then. Carrying on the family line, having children to look after you in your old age, were viewed as essentials. And all the family would have felt the growing shame as neither Ruth nor Orpah produced children, as Naomi has no grandchildren. For Ruth and Orpah, they've probably taken a little bit of stigma for marrying an immigrant family. And now everyone's looking at them going, well, you started worshipping this other god, and you've joined this outsider family, and now you've got no kids. You're being judged. You're wrong. There's some shame. But there's time. They're probably married fairly young. There's time. And no doubt Naomi prayed earnestly for babies to come. And the years go on, and the childlessness remains, and the disappointment rises. But there's time, and then the boys die. Mahlon and Chilion die. Naomi, who's had the joy of seeing these sons growing to men and marrying, is left with no children and no grandchildren. Her line in Israel is finished. Her hope of a comfortable old age is gone. And as for Ruth and Orpah, they're now widows, tainted in their own country by marriage to foreigners, probably viewed as less desirable because of their barrenness. And instead of husbands to support them doing the really hard labor in the fields, they now have to support a mother-in-law. Bereaved, left to scratch out a living. And going to Israel doesn't really help Ruth and Orpah. I mean, they'll still be without protection or provision, still suspect as foreigners, unattractive because of their barrenness. Don't rush over this. When Naomi says, "My life is very bitter," she's just telling it like it is. Taste the bitterness as Naomi returns to Bethlehem, as she walks in and she sees the families that chose to stay prospering, children and grandchildren, and a prosperous harvest, while she is poor and bereaved and without descendants. And so on top of all her bitterness and pain, she now also has that horrible thing, the might have beens. What would have happened if we'd stayed? Might I now have grandchildren? Why do we linger on the emotion? Why do we dig into it this morning? Because many of us have bitter disappointments in our lives. Some we've come through, come out the other side. Some we're going through. Some await us. Bitter disappointments are a reality. Failed careers, bankrupt businesses, lack of breakthrough in the sports or creative industries, or failures in love, or broken marriages, childlessness, or children going off the rails, homes repossessed, tragic accidents, suicides, nagging illnesses. I don't know where the disappointments will come, or have already come for all of you, but I know that some people in this room are living at this moment with bitter disappointment. And it is good to remember that people who were in God's plan, people who were godly people, have suffered disappointment, severe and sustained disappointment. And that means that the good news of the rest of Ruth is good news for those who are facing disappointments. We need to remember we're not the first to struggle to face disappointments. And then listen and learn from how God's people have faced these disappointments and how God in the end has worked in their lives, the hope that is found later in the chapters in Ruth. Because chapter 1 is a pretty depressing chapter. That's because you're kind of meant to read the whole thing. There's a tradition in Judaism where you read the whole thing at the harvest time. You read the whole book, you get the downwards of chapter 1, but you're straight away starting on the upward trajectory for the rest of the book. We're doing just the chapter 1, so we're spending more time in the misery. But next week we'll get onto the upwards trajectory. But in the midst of the plunge down, in the midst of the horrible situations, I wonder if you notice just what a lovely picture you get of Naomi and Ruth. It's one of the striking features of the book of Ruth. In the midst of difficulties, every major character behaves well. They are models for us. It's not a sort of soap opera where everyone behaves badly. Naomi and Ruth and later Boaz are all admirable, kind, godly, and we're meant to learn from them. So just for a minute, twos or threes, what do you think are some of the lessons we can learn from Naomi and Ruth in chapter 1 of Ruth? Have a chat, twos or threes. Particularly about how we live with disappointment. Okay, let's share some things. Hope you've got some different things and you've done all the hard work of what does this sermon teach us? What does this passage teach us? So what things can we learn from Naomi and Ruth in the way they handle disappointment? Anyone got any suggestions? Yeah.
They're both thinking about the other one more than themselves.
Mm, yeah, so they're both thinking about others even in their disappointment. That's really important. Yeah.
Naomi didn't go to an evangelical church where everything's always fine, no matter how rubbish it is.
Okay, yeah, could you want to flesh that out a little bit?
good point. Yeah. We're often not very good at saying, actually, the situation as it stands is pretty rubbish. Because I think often we have a quite right sense of God's honour, and we are afraid that if we say life is sucky and everything is rubbish, that will in some way sort of diminish God's glory or say he's not looking after us or something like that. Mm. So often I think it's out of good motives, but the result is that we can often be very shallow and superficial.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So Rich said that, made a very good point, there's no blame from one to the other, or including with Orpah either.
Yeah. Yeah, really, yeah. There could easily have been lots of, well, if only you'd produced grandchildren, we'd be in a better situation or something like that. You know, there could easily have been blame on going around, but there isn't any. Yeah.
So Naomi releases Ruth from sort of any obligation that she has to
come back with her, and then Ruth has to choose to do that anyway.
Yep.
So it's one thing to sort of be sacrificial when you know that's what's expected of you, but to actually choose that willingly to basically give up the rest of your life for nothing is astonishingly sacrificial.
Great, yeah. Fantastic. Well, those are all great answers. Let me talk through some of the things that I was thinking about as I was preparing. Hopefully, you'll see that they chime with quite a lot of things that have been said, and we just dig a little bit deeper into them. So the first thing that we learn is to be kind and witness to God in your disappointments. So I think that's really what Naomi teaches us. And people have commented on this. So in verse 6, Naomi learns that the Lord has come to the aid of his people and provided food for them. She decides to go back among her own people. There might be some family members there who can care for an aunt or whatever, and she'll get more help there. For her, it's a sensible move. And as she's walking along the road, she thinks about her daughters-in-law with her, and she thinks, they'll get less support if I go to Israel. They're more likely to find family support in Moab. They should go back to their family homes. So verse 8, go back each of you to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. And we just think about Naomi, bitterly disappointed, grieving the death now of husband and sons and the lack of grandchildren, and without any obvious means of support. And she's not self-obsessed. She doesn't say, because my life has been so bad, now everyone must serve me. In her bitter disappointment, she continues to be kind, to think of what is good for others, and especially here for her daughters-in-law. Now, there is a slightly odd bit, isn't there, in verses 11 to 13 about, I'm a bit too old to have sons who will grow up and become husbands for you. And that's just slightly weird for us culturally, but basically in a time before the welfare state, that's one of the ways that was sort of set up to enable a widow to be cared for. A childless widow would marry a brother of her husband, and that would mean that she kept being cared for by the family. So slightly weird cultural point there aside, the point is Naomi is thinking about what is good for Orpah and Ruth. She's kind. And just to give a trivial example, the moment I have a headache, I cease to be kind to others and I become very selfish. We have this tendency when we feel like we're under pressure, that now I don't need to be kind anymore. But the Bible doesn't say be kind unless you're having a hard time. Kindness and consideration of others, doing good to them, is God's call all the time, including in our difficulties. And Naomi is a great example for us of that. And alongside this kindness goes a witness to the kindness of the Lord, Yahweh, the God of Israel. I mean, just think about the blessing she prays down, or calls for in verse 8. May the Lord show you kindness, as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. Here is Naomi in the land of Moab, where they worship all sorts of other gods, and she is the least prosperous person in the land. And she says, may my God bless you. I mean, it would have looked like her God is either weak or against her, and yet she continues to believe in God and to speak of him and to say he's the one who brings blessing. And so she says, may Yahweh, the God of Israel, show you kindness. When we're in difficulty, one of the dangers is we can just shut God out of our thinking entirely. But another is, as Kim was saying, we can feel like, how on earth could we share him while our life is so full of mess and bitter disappointment? I'll wait till a better time to talk about Jesus when my life is a bit more of an advertisement for Jesus. When I have the big house, the lovely family, perfect health and a booming business, then I'll be able to talk about Jesus and people will think, yeah, Jesus must be pretty good. And Naomi's our model here. We are loyal to Jesus because he's the creator God, because he alone saves. We are loyal to him in our difficulties, and we're to witness to him, to speak of him, to commend him to others, even in the face of bitter disappointment in this life. He remains the true God. And good news, even when we are in dark places. And he can use our witness, even when we think our lives look pretty empty and useless. Because that's what we see in Ruth. That point that in verse 16, she is set free from all obligation and she has to make a choice. She chooses to commit to God and his people in the middle of the disappointments of life. Grew up in Moab, worshipping the gods of Moab. She married an Israelite, probably agreed to join the family's worship of Yahweh, the God of Israel. Spent years, maybe even up to a decade, living in this family. So she's worshipped Yahweh. She's heard of the great deeds of God in rescuing the Israelites from Egypt. And she's seen the kindness and honesty of this family of Yahweh worshippers. There's something about them. But she's also seen a lot of unanswered prayers. Prayers for children, prayers for recovery of Mahlon and Chilion. And she's grieving the barrenness she's afflicted with, the lack of children. And she's grieving a good husband's death. And she's looking to a future with bleak prospects and low status and walking along the road with a mother-in-law to a strange place where in all likelihood she will die an outcast stranger. And everything is in place for her to turn away from God, to say, I've tasted and it wasn't very tasty. I'm going to turn back to my old gods and my old family. But she doesn't. At the very lowest point of her life, she doesn't ignore God who allowed these sufferings or say, the whole God question is when I have to leave to a better day. There on the road, this day, she makes her choice and she commits herself to Yahweh in the middle of her disappointments. And she commits herself to his people in the middle of her disappointments and bitterness. Verse 16, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. There are always reasons not to investigate Christianity or not to now make the step of committing my life to Jesus, trusting him. Either life is going well and you're too busy with other things, or life is going badly and you don't feel like it. But Ruth shows us that in the very darkest of times, people can see God as good news, can see Jesus as good news and commit to following him and joining his people. And she shows us that that can happen even though the cost is tremendously high. She is a grieving widow who's going to leave behind her parents and her family, her homeland and her culture, and her most realistic chances at marriage. And she leaves it all behind to be part of God's people and to worship the true God. If you're here today and you're in a bitter place, don't wait until you've sorted it all out to trust in Jesus, to commit yourself to him. Don't wait until you're in a better place to join God's people in a church. Ruth is the model here. She's an encouragement for us Christians to witness to those in difficult times, because people in difficult times, in grief and disappointment and pain, need Jesus and can respond to Jesus. But she's a challenge in her disappointments, not to use that as an excuse to hold back from God. Because Ruth stepped up to trust God and go where God wanted, in the midst of the disappointment. And as you hear of Naomi's kindness and witness and Ruth's commitment, you might be thinking, that just sounds really unrealistic. When I'm in a bitter place, I don't feel like that. And one of the things that this passage also encourages us to do is to lament our bitterness in our disappointments. Because Naomi is very public about her pain in her loss, and she publicly says, and it's God's doing. Verse 13, it is more bitter for me than for you because the Lord's hand has turned against me. It's not lack of faith in God. God is God. He's to be worshipped. God is a God who is kind and can bring blessing. But God is named as the one. He brought this bitterness. And the same thing happens when Naomi returns to Bethlehem, the house of bread, verse 20. Don't call me Naomi, which means pleasant, she told them. Call me Mara, which means bitter. Because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So just in case they missed it the first time, she sort of says it another two times. God did this. My life is miserable. A public naming of her bitterness, a linking it to God. Now I wonder how you'd feel if someone came into church and you asked them how they're doing and they started talking like this. Culturally, English culture is often reserved and unwilling to express emotions so rawly. To the extent that, if I just think of a case where I was sitting with a man whose best friend had committed suicide, and he apologized to me as his pastor because he had to pause and cry. That's how reserved English culture can get, isn't it? That we don't express our grief very well. And of course, in Christian circles, we can easily feel uncomfortable about so directly laying our suffering at God's door. The Almighty has brought this misfortune upon me. Because we kind of want to, as Kim was saying, we want to be good witnesses. So we want to say, God is good, and you know, he's not directly the cause of evil, but he allows, you know, we have all sorts of caveats and wanting to protect God's reputation, and yet the Bible is full of lament, and in the weeping, and in the honest calling out to God, people are saying, God, you did this, and God, you need to sort it out. So church should be a place when asked, how are you doing, where the answer doesn't always have to be fine, and where tears can flow, and people can say, places God's leading me in my life are not places I want to be. It feels horrible. I am Mara, bitter today. I longed to have whatever it was. I lost these things. I'm in pain for these reasons. And we're meant to lament our bitterness and to name the bitterness and to say I'm in grief about it and to acknowledge God as the one who has allowed this to happen and who could have stopped it. You know, we're not meant to get God off the hook here. Yes, God doesn't directly cause evil. Yes, sometimes the problems we face are partly linked to our own foolish choices, but God is God, and Naomi's absolutely right to see. God has brought her back empty. God is all-powerful, the Almighty. He could have stopped this, and he didn't. While we believe what the New Testament says, in all things God is working for good for those who love him, yet we also have to say he's in charge. And this mess is something he has allowed. And we're not offending God when we bring our troubles to him in this way and say, God, I believe you're good. I'm sticking with you, but I feel rubbish. And the path you have led me on is not the path I wanted to be on at all. And right now, God, all I feel is bitterness and disappointment, and I can't see the way forward. Naomi is a godly model in her grieving. It's one of those things where we sometimes think, oh, she should have been a bit more stoic. I think she's being held out as a model here. We should be able to express our grief and our disappointment, to say the Lord has done this to me and I'm bitter and empty at this time. So we learn a lot from the godly example of Naomi and Ruth. And I think the way that whoever wrote this has shaped it also gives us a hint of one thing that Naomi is not seeing. She's not seeing the glimmers of hope. So we should be kind and we should witness to God in our bitterness. We can commit to God and his people in the midst of bitterness. We can publicly lament how God has brought this trouble on us. But while the chapter is full of bitterness, the book of Ruth ends with joy. Marriage for Ruth, a grandson for Naomi, prosperity and honor for both. And better than that, both of them are now part of the family line. They're connected to the family of the king and the ultimate greater king who will come. And we don't know how our stories are going to end in terms of their weaving around on this earth. Not every childless widow gets married and has children. But if we trust in Christ, we know that the very end of our story is fantastic. We are the bride of Christ, made perfect, loved by him forever, enjoying ruling a new creation with him, free from pain or loss or bitterness. But it does seem that Naomi has lost sight of that ultimate promise of God's blessing. And she doesn't see the glimmers of hope even in her own story. Verse 22 gives us the glimmers of hope. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. So as we just look at these glimmers of hope, we're also meant to be looking at our own lives if we're in bitterness and think, have I missed some of the glimmers of hope? When Naomi left Bethlehem, there was no bread in the house of bread. As she returns, there is just about to be a plentiful harvest. The barley harvest was beginning. In her family life, she left full and returns empty. But God's at work now in a new way. She's heard in Moab that God is providing food for his people. God is meeting one need, the need for food. There's more of that coming. This barley harvest is the season in which all of the rest of the story takes place. God hasn't withdrawn every blessing from his people. He's the one who, and the one who meets one need now may well be meeting more needs in the future, supplying other good things. By the end of the barley harvest, there'll be a truly happy end to the story. And so even in our emptiness and bitterness, God sustains us and his people. And in the provision of others and the way that they help us, we have glimmers of hope, glimpses of final blessing. And the other thing Naomi has neglected is the presence of Ruth. I went back full and came back empty. Sorry, I went out full, I came back empty, she says. Forgetting that there is somebody next to her. Ruth. Naomi's not alone. God has put Ruth there alongside her, a hard worker who will glean for food, a kind daughter-in-law who loves and provides for her mother. She's not the husband or son or grandson Naomi hoped for, but she's a blessing from the Lord. And by the final chapter, the women will say to Naomi, Ruth, your daughter-in-law, loves you and is better than seven sons. And so, in the midst of disappointments, we're meant to look out for those who God has given us. The encouragers who are there, the companions along the way, the friends who may not have been our goal, but who are God's blessing to us. And that's what church family is meant to be. A network of brothers and sisters who support each other and provide for each other and encourage each other. And even if they fail, and sometimes even as loving brothers and sisters in Christ, we fail each other, Jesus himself is with us by his Spirit, a friend who never lets go and never fails us. And so we have glimmers of hope in our disappointment, and we should not neglect them. We should hold on to and look out for. Where is God at work now, and where are there those signs of what he might do more? God sustains. God provides companions. God can turn situations around, and God is with us. Let's just have a bit of quiet to reflect on our own life, perhaps current or past disappointments and how we've handled that, perhaps how we might help others, and then we'll sing a couple of songs which speak of holding on to God in the difficulties and how he holds on to us. So let's take a moment of quiet to reflect for ourselves. Father, thank you. Thank you for this book. Thank you for its realism about how people who know and love you experience such severe disappointments and feel it. Please help us to learn how to walk faithfully to you in the midst of disappointments, and how to be a church that loves each other and cares for each other and supports each other through our disappointments. Amen.